You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, some old books are getting some new language. Works by British authors Roald Dahl and Ian Fleming are seeing new editions published that either remove, reword, or otherwise revise words or sentences that might be offensive. While the efforts aren't about banning James and the Giant Peach or James Bond, it brings up the question of whether or not texts like this should be updated and how doing so affects current readers and future readers. And it comes at a time when many books are being removed from shelves in libraries and schools because of ideological opposition to their content. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this? Publishers, copyright holders, moves to revise Roald Dahl and Ian Fleming books for a more modern audience? Do you think they should stay as they were written? Is it worth updating them for newer audiences? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Adam Lotz is a professor of education and history at Binghamton University in New York, author of the book The Other School Reformers, Conservative Activism in American Education. He was a middle school and high school teacher in Milwaukee for 10 years and got his PhD at UW-Madison. Adam, welcome to Central Time and welcome back to Wisconsin.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be back.
Well, let's look at what we know about what the owners of these properties, these books, are doing to change things, starting with Roald Dahl. Now, he's got a lot of legendary kids' books, the Charlie and Chocolate Factory, things like that. What do you see as the nature of the changes that they're looking at making there?
Well, from what I've seen, they're changing language to make it less offensive. So, for example, the Roald Dahl changes seem to be a lot of, like, really sexist and pretty angry language in some of the originals, you know. So, for example, referring to older women as old hags, you know, they're taking that language out. Instead of referring to a woman as maybe being a secretary, they're referring to her as being a successful executive. You know, they're taking out some, for one thing, some of the sexist language, and also some of the racially loaded stuff. So, you know, these caretakers, for example, in earlier editions, are being rebranded as, you know, just people of shorter stature, you know, that kind of thing.
What do you think? Let's stay with Roald Dahl for a minute. What do you think about this idea of releasing a new version of these books, but changing the language in ways that, you know, might, I don't know, might be less offensive, might be more sensitive to people's needs?
Well, I think it's the worst possible approach to this kind of situation. And it's both as a teacher and as a citizen and as a historian, it seems like this move by the person who the company that owns the copyright, it seems like it picked an unnecessarily worst case scenario for how to address these problems. So, for example, one thing people could do if a book is old and its language is offensive and angry and derogatory, full of derogatory stereotypes, you know, the book could just fade out. And obviously the owners didn't want to do that. The owners of the copyright didn't want to do that. The second thing, if it's a great work of literature, or maybe, like you said, it's like a legendary book that people want to keep for their generations for sentimental reasons, you give it context. You explain to new readers where this language comes from and why it was used at the time and why it's offensive and why we don't use it anymore. But they did instead of doing either of those things, instead of making it a chance for kids to learn about both the story and where it comes from, they just sort of slapped a smiley face sticker over it. And that doesn't help. That ruins the book, and it blocks the kids who are reading the book from knowing where any of this came from or what the problem was in the first place. So in my opinion, it's the worst possible way to go.
And then we've got Ian Fleming. Now, this is the James Bond author. He wrote many books about the legendary fictional spy. Changing some of the descriptions, especially of characters of color. And I understand Ian Fleming had done this himself for one of his books. And now his estate is saying, in effect, we're picking up where he left off as we republish these. Do you have a similar reaction?
Similar, but they even seem to have done a worse job. You know, so for example, the new edits, they take some things out that are, you know, offensive and derogatory, but they leave some things in, like famously, you know, if you remember the Sean Connery era, the old James Bond was not just winking, but sort of smiling at sexual violence. And they, the new editions, quote unquote new, because they left some of that, the, in my opinion, the most offensive stuff, they left it in. So they tried to do a bad solution, and it seems like they didn't even do a very good job of it.
I want to look into why this is happening a little bit. Now, when you see the headlines about this, you might think, oh, you know, maybe an angry group gathered in person in front of the publisher's headquarters, or an online mob or something like this. The Roald Dahl, now Netflix has the rights to a lot of this, and they're, it looks like they're creating a Roald Dahl cinematic universe, basically. So a lot of money at stake here for them. And of course, the James Bond movie franchise has made lots and lots of money. These are people who own the rights to a license to print money. Why do you think they are the ones driving this kind of change?
Well, I mean, I think the reasons are obvious. And honestly, I think the desire to keep a title relevant and to keep it profitable is a whole different category from even, you know, conservative parents who are concerned about some of the titles that their kids will be reading. And they're concerned because they care about their kids. Like, I may disagree with a lot of that, as I do. I don't think books, you know, like And Tango Makes Three, you know, the Penguin book. Mm-hmm. I don't think books like that should be kept from children. I think children should have access to them. But I sympathize when parents and teachers are concerned if certain topics and ideas are appropriate for their kids. At least we're all concerned about the kids. This is just a concern for maximum profitability. So I really think it deserves to be in its own category.
We're talking to Adam Lotz, professor of education and history at Binghamton University, looking at new editions, slightly revised editions of Roald Dahl, books for kids, Ian Fleming, books about James Bond, changing some of the language aimed at making it less offensive. Again, some money at stake at both properties. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hi. What do you think?
Okay. When you guys started this conversation, I had all I could do from going from screaming like you got to be kidding me to just laughing. This has gotten, we have gone to such an extreme of, oh, heaven forbid we can't offend somebody. You have to look at the time period when these books were written, when these movies were made. Okay? It's how it was. You can't change history. And to sit here and, oh, we have to cleanse all of this stuff. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm a construction worker. We leave our feelings at home. And if somebody's feelings got hurt, oh, well, they'll get over it.
Pat,
but it is what it is.
Pat, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Adam, what do you think?
Well, hi, Pat. Thanks for the call. Go Packers. I don't agree that we shouldn't, like, I think we should, we do as a society need to be careful and need to be paying attention to what especially children are reading and exposed to. I don't think that it's going too far to be worried about what kids will be seeing. And if there are old books, not just Roald Dahl, not just Ian Fleming, but, you know, Mark Twain and Of Mice and Men is the other one that often gets criticized for having, you know, racial language that's really derogatory in it. I think it's wise for us, whatever our politics, to be paying attention to what children are reading. And if there are books out there that have, negative depictions of women or of conservatives, we need to look at that and say, hey, is it worth it? Is this book so fantastic? Is it so important? Is this movie so vital to kids understanding history that we want them to see it and we want to help them understand it? Like Pat said, it is how things were in the past, and kids should understand that. So just doing what the Roald Dahl owners did and just kind of taking parts out as if they never existed, that's bad. Some books really should be read, even with the offensive content. I agree. But students need guidance. They need to understand why Mark Twain used that N-word so much if they're going to read it. They can't just be left on their own, and if it hurts them, too bad. That's too harsh. That's not what we want for our children.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Adam Lotz, professor of education and history at Binghamton University, former teacher in Milwaukee middle school and high schools, about recent news about revised editions of books by Roald Dahl and Ian Fleming. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest? Are you a student, parent, teacher, a librarian? What are your thoughts on, you know, changing these books retroactively to take out some things that are offensive? If you work with material with kids that, yeah, it's older stuff, there's some bad stuff in it, how do you deal with that? How do you talk to that reader? How do you explain what's different from then to now? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Adam Lotz, professor of education and history at Binghamton University and former Milwaukee teacher. Talk about issues of literary censorship and updating for relevance after the news that publishers are updating books by Roald Dahl. He's the James the Giant Peach author, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and Ian Fleming, that's the James Bond author, to remove or revise what's now seen as offensive content. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Hi, Chris.
Hi, sir. Say, I'm listening to the conversation here, and whereas I do agree with the guests that removing language is not necessarily the right answer. Again, these things are being removed from private pieces of work. They're owned by a private company. The publisher is doing this, not necessarily the artist, if you will. And they're in business to make money, so they're going to do whatever they have to do to sell the most product. So it's not really for a benefit of anybody, but if they think it's going to sell more product, sure, they're going to remove language.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Adam, yeah, I don't think there's any argument. If they hold the copyrights, they can do what they want with it with the intention of making money. I think you're just not happy with the outcome.
Well, sure. Yeah. And it's a great point, Chris. But I think that there's two elements that make it a bigger question. The one is that I think there's an implication that the company or the copyright owners are feeling some sort of pressure to change this. And I think there are people who find that pressure a shame, who say books like James and the Giant Peach should be free to use the language that was, you know, from the time that they were written, and that it's a travesty that the publishers should feel the pressure. And right, it's just market pressure. But some people feel it's a shame, worse than a shame, that they should have to change what people view as a classic children's book because of excessive sensitivity toward current norms. I don't agree, but I think that's the issue more than just can a private company change one of its properties. I think most people agree with that.
Thanks a lot for that call. Mike joins us next in Waukesha. Mike, hello.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Mike?
Well, I heard the construction worker earlier, and he brought up a point that this is all in the past. But what's going on as we speak is unbelievably offensive language that kids that you're talking about are hearing or reading things like Mark Twain or this, that, and the next thing, with which may or may not have the N-word in it. And how do you differentiate that they might be reading it in a book, which I highly doubt, as opposed to hearing it at home on some of the obscenely offensive songs that are out right now, and that you want to take away an American classic like Mike or Mark Twain and edit it and leave everything else out there.
I gotcha, Mike. Thanks for the call. So distinguishing, I guess, between a music that might contain offensive words versus a book that we might teach in school. Adam, do you have a line you'd want to draw for Mike?
Well, I do. It's a great point. Especially, we don't just have to say songs. You know, when school districts or governors or, you know, ambitious pundits say that, you know, this book or that book should be banned, it's just, it's hard for anyone. You don't have to be a middle school or a high school teacher to point out that every adolescent has the internet in their pocket right now at all times. It's not books that they're mostly looking at. It's TikTok and other media. So sure, you know, I think Mike makes a great point. Why are we obsessing about books? I think one of the reasons, the good reasons, in my opinion, it's not just that this information is out there. We're talking about books in most cases, not James Bond, but these other ones that are being given to kids at school. And I think that's part of the problem. It's books that seem to be, like Mark Twain was a great example. A book that comes from a teacher or from a library seems to have a different status, even to children, than just some random, you know, internet content that they see or that someone, you know, sends them or whatever. So I do think it is a different thing and a more important conversation to talk about things that are part of library collections and school content. The biggest problem, in my opinion, is that it's a conversation that's difficult to have. You know, does a particular work of art merit inclusion in a school library or classroom? We need to have a sensitive, open conversation. When the politics get to be the way they do, that's exactly what we can't have.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike. We're talking to Adam Lotz from Binghamton University, professor of education and history there, former teacher here in Wisconsin, looking at changes in new editions by a couple of well-known authors, Roald Dahl and Ian Fleming, taking out offensive content from the original works when they are republished. Let's bring on another caller now. Bob is with us in Madison. Bob, hello.
Hello. I want to bring up two specific authors that I know have had revisions both physically in their books and in a lot of their audiobooks. I'm a tremendous fan of H.P. Lovecraft and Robert E. Howard, and they have unfortunately been outspokenly kind of, well, colorful in their language. But it's one of those aspects of seeing their works revised just in the slightest way when it had no real negative connotation necessarily to the story that was being portrayed. It just seems like it's editing down something that, and I agree, I forget what the guy's name was, but he's the construction worker. It was a sign of the times. And it does bring up to me that, like, if we don't remember that language like that was used, terms like that were used, that they'll get reused. Like, again, history will repeat itself.
Bob, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. I remember reading H.P. Lovecraft, and the N-word pops up in one story that I remember kind of surprisingly. Adam, the approach, if I'm hearing you right, wouldn't be to take that out, but maybe have some kind of, like, introduction putting it into context.
Right. And I was also, when I was younger, a big fan of H.P. Lovecraft. And I remember wondering about it with that book, kind of like Roald Dahl, kind of like Ian Fleming. I never read that. I think they're sort of sideways, you know, on the side of school curriculum. Mm-hmm. So I think the question we need to have with any book, H.P. Lovecraft is a good example. Is this a powerful enough piece of literature for social reasons, for historical reasons, for literary reasons, for aesthetic reasons, that we want to help kids understand why the language is so offensive and angry? And Lovecraft really was, you know, it was the universe was very stacked racially in those books.
Mm-hmm. Bob, thanks a lot for that call. Adam, you've highlighted the tension between kind of our political conversation about what books kids have access to in libraries and in schools, and maybe a more productive way of talking about it. How do we get from that very angry version to a more productive conversation that puts the interests of kids at the middle of it?
Yeah, well, the good news is that we're doing it every day, and you wouldn't necessarily get that if you just looked at Twitter and the newspapers. But these are conversations that parents, librarians, teachers have been having forever. You know, do you think a specific family might have an objection to a book that a school uses in its curriculum, in its English classes. And almost always they talk about it and they just work it out, because the good news is that, you know, families trust their teachers. So when they, when the Gallup organization asks American parents, how are schools doing? You know, huge majority of people say, oh, schools are terrible. But then when they ask a follow-up, how are your kids' schools? Huge majorities of parents say, oh, my kids' schools are great. My kids' teachers are great. We trust them. And we have conversations like this all the time. And that's what we need to focus on. We all want the best for our kids.
Adam, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Adam Lotz, professor of education and history at Binghamton University, author of the book The Other School Reformers, Conservative Activism in American Education. We talked to him today about the past and present of book revisions in the United States and how parents, educators, and librarians can make decisions about what to share with and teach young readers. This after new editions coming out of Roald Dahl, the children's book author Ian Fleming, the James Bond author, the copyright holders putting out new editions with some changes geared at making parts of them, they hope, less offensive and more purchasable. You can keep sharing your thoughts on the issue. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. A Ukrainian-American chef joins us to share delicious recipes and the importance of the kitchen in Ukrainian culture. First, I'm in my 50s, and the thing is, I've sort of always felt like I was in my 50s, and I just kind of grew into that age. Well, apparently, I am a statistical outlier. Researchers have found that on average, people over 40 see themselves as 20% younger than they actually are. So 50-year-olds think of themselves as 40, a 65-year-old maybe is 52. This concept of how old you are in your mind is called subjective age, and it's not always in line with our actual calendar age. We're talking about age and why we often feel younger than we actually are. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel your age? Have you always felt that? Do you feel like you are younger than the calendar claims you are? If we ask you, how old do you feel? What is the number you would share? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jennifer Senior is a staff writer at The Atlantic and the author of the forthcoming On Grief, Love, Loss, and Memory, which won the 2022 Pulitzer Prize when it was first published in the magazine. She recently wrote about this idea of subjective age and why it's often different than our real age. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh my God, it's so nice to be here. How are you?
Good. Well, you went looking for research on this idea of subjective age. There's not a ton of it, but you did find some. Tell us what researchers have found.
I did find some. And, you know, here there is a lot of research if you're just looking in the field of gerontology. Like, people have been asking since the 70s, how old do you feel? And to me, this is like a boring question, because lo and behold, if you feel younger than you are, you're probably in pretty good health and you probably are going to, you know, live longer. This to me is, you know, one of these dispatches from the Department of the Extraordinarily Obvious, like, duh, right? I was interested in the question of how old are you in your head? Mm-hmm. Like, how old do you perceive yourself to be mentally? And you're absolutely right. There's a lot less about that out there. The most interesting study that I found, the one with the most sort of inspired way of framing the question, which was how old are you in your head? It was nicely designed. It had a big sample size. It had like 1,000 people in it. And it found that, yeah, if you are north of 40, odds are statistically, you are going to think of yourself as 20% younger than you are. But here's what was also interesting. If you're younger than 25, you're going to think of yourself as older, which sort of makes sense intuitively to me from both directions. Apparently this made no sense to you. For what it's worth, it made no sense to my husband either, who looked at me as I was writing this and like kept crossing his eyes and saying, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, no, but that's why anyway. This is so fascinating to me, because I don't, like, if you threw that question at me, I would, like, I guess I feel my age. But so many people, I think you included, and a lot of people you just threw that question at, they instantly respond with a number that's lower than their calendar age, right?
and lower than 20%. Like, I was surprised. I mean, when I speak to people, just my informal, you know, N of 100 or whatever, I mean, it's way lower. You know, I was by no means weird as a 53-year-old seeing myself as a 36-year-old. Like, that was pretty consistent. And once I wrote this piece and the cascade began on Twitter, it had this like unusually viral life, this piece. People were giving me all kinds of really young ages that did not correspond, frankly, with the 20% shave off. It was much closer to 30 and 40. And oh, by the way, if I can just say, mm-hmm. one of the most common answers that I got on Twitter that I think speaks to this, and which would suggest that it's a lot less than or a lot more than 20%. I can't tell you how many people wrote to me and said that like they would drop off their mother at assisted living and their mother would look at them and say, mm-hmm. please don't make me stay here. It's filled with old people.
Yeah, I remember my grandma complaining about all the senior citizens, you know, in her mid 70s.
There you go.
Yeah. Now,
and what was she? I mean, right.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know the age she thought she was, but it wasn't her actual age. That's for sure. Now, right. What do we know about why? Why do we do this?
Okay. So I'm glad that you asked. I find the answers that social science gives incredibly unsatisfying, which is not surprising. I think you really need like novelists to answer some of the most interesting questions, you know, that kind of come out of these lines of inquiry. I mean, they all gave answers like it's ageism, right? It's internalized ageism that Americans and Westerners just consider aging a catastrophe. And we have and there's some evidence for this. I mean, because when you look at the cross-cultural studies, people in Asia and people in Africa shave less, shave fewer years off of their age. So on the one hand, maybe there's something to that because in Asia and in Africa, there's more respect for the elderly. There's, you know, in Japan, there's like respect for the aged day. There's all kinds of things, you know. So, you know, I get that. But I think that there are a number of things. And I think one of them is that, first of all, it could be seen as a form of optimism that we think of ourselves as having, you know, one or two or three pivots left in us. So we don't think of ourselves as being the age that we are, you know. I think that some of it is that the older you get, you know, the smaller a year is increasingly a smaller and smaller percentage or fraction of your life. So you're more inclined to maybe identify with an age where a year felt longer to you. I think that's a distinct possibility. I think also people identify with the age that they were sort of in a professional or personal sweet spot. That seems to happen a lot where it's sort of their potential and their competence were in perfect equipoise. That seems to be a very common answer. So like for me, 36 was an age where I was still brimming with potential. I knew what the contours of my life looked like, but they hadn't been filled in yet, you know? So I think that's some of it. What are other answers? We spent a lot more time being younger than we did being older.
That's fair.
It's just like a raw numerical response, I mean, I guess.
Talking to Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic about a piece she wrote about subjective age, the idea that the age we are in our heads doesn't always match up with what the calendar says. Love to hear your answer to these questions at 800-642-1234. If I ask you, how old are you in your head? Is it the same as your age, like it is pretty much for me, or is it different, like it is for, I guess, most people? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Sun Prairie. Mike, hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about?
It applies to me, and I think there's probably a segment that it applies to, you know, in the population is, I have three children, but I started later. I had my first child when I was 38. And I think, you know, the saying kids keep you young would be a big part of why I consider myself at least 8 years younger than I really am. And I think there's data out that says people are having kids later in life. And that may just be one possible reason that, you know, your kids force you to stay younger, at least mentally.
I am so glad. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no. Thanks, Mike, for the call. Jennifer, go ahead.
No, I'm so glad he said that. Mike is absolutely right. And I forgot to say that, that it's, a lot of this is that we are deferring some of the things that our parents' generation did younger. And so that is exactly right. And I think that we have in our heads, and Mike probably has in his head, and by the way, I was also 38 when my kid was born, 37 when I got pregnant. I think we have in our heads an image of what 50 looks like or 40 looks like based on our parents. And also, you know, a generation ago or whatever, people smoked. They didn't have the same like skincare products. Their diets were worse. They did sort of in some ways look older in addition to sort of starting earlier. Somebody blew my doors off by recently pointing out to me that Carol O'Connor and Jean Stapleton and all of the family, you know, when they were playing, you know, Archie Bunker and Edith, they were in their 40s. I mean, if you held a gun to my head, I would have said they were in their 60s.
50s, 60s, I would have guessed. 50s, yeah.
60s. Yeah, right.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike. I appreciate it. We're talking to staff writer Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic about her article on subjective age, the age you are in your head versus your actual calendar chronological age, and why those two numbers often don't match up for a lot of people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have that where in your head you are younger than the number that, you know, is on the calendar, or maybe older? That is true, especially for younger people. If you're in the middle, I don't know. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Jennifer Senior, staff writer at The Atlantic, looking at her recent piece headlined, "I'm 56 year old, I'm 36 in my head." We're talking about why it is that a lot of people feel younger, their mental self-image is younger than their actual age. And you can join in with your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Scott is with us in Eau Claire. Scott, hi.
Hi. My comment is, you know, I look at all these younger people around me and I just feel like, you know, I look at them, the way the shape they're in, and everybody complains about working. I've been working 70-hour weeks pretty much since I've been a teenager. And to this day, I still work those hours and they complain. And it, I think most of it's like the feeling of a work ethic and keeping in shape and just not being lazy. Everybody nowadays, these kids want to play video games. They want to do this. They want to do that. Nobody wants to work anymore. It's just like
I want to hear some numbers from you, Scott. Your age versus how old you feel or how old your self-image is.
I'm 56, and I feel like I'm 35 or younger.
Excellent, Scott. Thanks a lot for the call. Now, Jennifer, we heard Scott's numbers. He chalks it up to, I think, some of his attitudes and his approach to life there.
Yeah, I'm disinclined to actually say that it's because people have different work ethics. I think I would just have to respectfully disagree with him. I mean, I think that, you know, how old we are in our heads is sort of a function perhaps of how many good years we feel like we have left as productive workers. You know, I mean, I still feel like I could keep writing for the next 25 years if somebody wanted. You know, that's how I feel now anyway. And, you know, we've got like an 80-year-old president. We had until recently a speaker who was in her 80s. You know, I mean, There are examples of this all over American life of people who lead, you know, who lead constructive lives and until, you know, right through their 80s, you know, as octogenarians. By the way, just one quick thing. Mm-hmm. Did you say I was 56? Because you don't need to rush me. I'm 53.
53. Okay. I think we got a typo in the headline there. 53 years old, 36. Got it.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in, Scott. I appreciate it. We'll go back to your call. Louise is with us in Dodgeville. Louise, hi.
Hi. I went back to college later in life, and I just always had this like funny experience on campus. Like, you know, I'd be walking between classes and I'd have my backpack on, you know, and it's sunny out and I'm like walking along and I'm like, I'm 20 again, I'm 20. And then I'd be like, I'd catch myself like in the window reflection and I'd be like, oh my God, I do not look like I'm a 20-year-old walking around campus. But it's like funny.
I love it, Louise.
Funny how you get caught up in that, you know, or like your mind's eye versus, you know, the physical reality.
Louise, thank you so much. That's a great story. And Jennifer, it reminds me, I think in your piece you talk about this is common where, you know, a 50-year-old is talking to younger folks and thinking they're one of them, and they lose that consciousness of that age difference.
I'm so glad you brought that up. Yeah, it was a great comment because exactly. A friend, so it's not a friend. It's somebody I really respect in our business who's a social scientist, and his name is Ian Leslie. He wrote to me privately, and he said, this on Twitter, and he said, I totally feel like I'm, you know, I'm 51 in plain old reality, but I also think of myself as being in my 30s. And whenever I'm talking to people in their 30s, I make the mistake of thinking I'm the same age as them. And I thought, oh my God, I have done that so many times in my life, to the point that like, I will start, just as this woman said, Louise, I think her name was, like, you know, thinking she's 20, blah, blah, blah. I'll think the exact same thing. And then somebody who is in their 30s will say something to me that will make me feel like I may as well be Dame Judi Dench or Maggie Smith, that I might as well be like a dowager from Downton Abbey, you know, and you realize, oh my God, they think that there is just this distance between us that can be measured in light years. You know, it's just crazy. So it's always very humbling when that happens.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Louise. I appreciate it. Judy joins us now in Franklin. Judy, hello.
Good afternoon to everyone. I am in my 70s, but I remember when I was much younger, when we went shopping, and I'm thinking more female than male, there were places in the store that were set for older ladies. Their shoes were different. Their hats were different. Everything was different. And now any woman going into a store, you go by brand or by size, but it doesn't necessarily set you with an age. And I think that may change how we reflect on age or how we see each other.
What an interesting observation, Judy. Thanks for that. What do you think, Jennifer?
I think it's a great, great point. And it goes to that point that I was saying earlier about, like, you know, I've got unguents that make my skin look younger. I don't smoke. None of us smoke. You know, I dress like my teenager dresses. I wear the same, you know, t-shirts and lucky jeans. You know, I mean, like, it's absolutely, she's absolutely right. I think that a lot of these distinctions have collapsed so that there's little reason. And again, and also we're deferring doing a lot of things that, you know, our parents did in their 20s. We're doing them in our 30s. So we, I don't know, we've held over whatever our youthful selves were, and our clothing and our music and our, in all these ways. I think it's true. I think she's right.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic. She wrote about subjective age, how old we are in our heads versus by the clock and the calendar. Before we go back to our callers, I wanted to get this. You reached out to Margaret Atwood, the author, now in her 80s, about her thoughts on this. Can you share some of her response with us?
Yeah, it was delightful. It was very typically her. I mean, she was sort of saying, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm 83 and I kind of like being 83. And, you know, when you're 53, when you're your age, you're sort of self-conscious about how much older you are than other people and whether people are going to think of you as old. But by the time you're my age, you really are old. So the pressure's off. And she said, so, you know, I time travel in my head every now and then and revisit the decades that I liked, but I actually enjoy being old. And I actually, you know, take pleasure in it, and I make old jokes, and you'll see that in some ways it's better than being 53. There are advantages to being old. And I think she's sort of symbolic of the work of a woman named Becca Levy, who's an epidemiologist up at Yale, who has shown that if you have a very positive attitude toward aging, you also age well. And I think that Becca Levy's work has in common with the body of literature that says its opposite, which is that if you think of yourself as young, you also age well. What they have in common is that in both instances, you see yourself as being useful. Whether you think you have a positive attitude toward aging and you're like, hey, I like being in my 80s. I've got wisdom. I've got this. I've got that. I've got stuff to contribute. Or whether you're, you know, younger and think of yourself as even younger, you think, I have stuff to contribute. It's the same thought. And I think that that's what ties them together.
Let's go back to our callers. Nancy is with us now in Ironwood. Nancy, hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What's your story, Nancy?
Well, I have a question. My husband is 65, but when he's talking about work, he's talking about how young he is and how he feels so great. And then we'll say something. The kids will say, hey, Dad, let's go snowmobiling or let's go here and there. And oh, no, I'm just too old for that. I'm 65. I don't get why he goes both ways.
Interesting, Nancy. Thanks a lot for that. Yeah, I don't know. I like what he's doing. He's using it strategically. He doesn't want to go snowmobiling, and he'll use that as his excuse.
Total. It's like selective hearing. I think it is consistent with something else that people have said to me, which is that if it will depend on the day or the minute or the hour, you know, if you ask them how old they are in their head. So it could be true that Nancy's husband feels young, you know, at the office, or I don't know if he's at an office, wherever he's working, you know. It might not be an office, but if he's asked to go snowmobiling, suddenly he's thinking, oh, I don't want to, like, you know, on the off chance that we run over a branch and I mm-hmm. get tossed out, I don't want to break anything. You know, I mean, I can feel incredibly young and then my knees will tell me something different, you know. It just depends.
Thanks for the call, Nancy. Time for one more caller. Janet is with us on the road. Janet, hi.
Hello, and she just mentioned her knees. So let me explain that I love this topic, and now you're giving a term subjective age to what I've been calling my emotional age. But I'm turning 71 next month. I think that's kind of funny. We have our chronological age. We have our what you're calling subjective age, where, as I'm saying, my emotions are, and I feel like a kid. I work with many people of ages at a seasonal job, and so I do speak to people about this, and they seem to like the topic of how old the sage is in our life. So our subjective age, and I think I'm in my 30s, 40s. But then you mentioned your knees, and that's the third one I usually add because it's how old our body is. And I've had so many surgeries, and I've had replacements, but it doesn't stop me from my subjective age of 30s and 40s.
Janet, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Jennifer, that takes us, I think, to a good point to wrap up with. I don't know, how can we embrace the best of our emotional age, as Janet says, or our subjective age?
I mean, I think that they're not incompatible, right? I mean, that's what I would say. But I think that it's true. Your knees are going to, and your hips or whatever, are going to tell you one story one day. But it's possible you're keeping your knees young by, you know, by having a different age in your head. It's hard to know, right? But I like her line about how she thinks that turning 71 is funny, because people do say to me that they look in the mirror and they just think that they've seen a system error, that there's just some kind of mistake. So I very much appreciated that aspect of her comment too.
Thanks for the call, Janet. And Jennifer, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Jennifer Senior is a staff writer at The Atlantic, author of the book On Grief. She recently wrote about subjective age and why the age in our mind is often lower than our real age, especially when we're over 50. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday as Chef shares delicious Ukrainian recipes and a celebration of Ukrainian culture. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.